This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm at the Defence Academy of the United Kingdom, and I'm talking with Tim Rawlings from NCC Group.
Hi, so my name's Tim Rawlings. I'm a director and senior advisor at NCC Group. We are the UK's largest specialist cybersecurity organisation with a global presence of sort of 35 offices, over 2,000 people around the world.
One of the things that's going on here today is we're talking about neurodiversity and cybersecurity. It's quite a challenge for a lot of people because they don't really understand what neurodiversity is. And when they look around their cybersecurity teams, they're scrambling to fill gaps. Where do people begin to start to introduce diversity into their cybersecurity?
I think from our point of view, we don't specially go out and particularly target autistic people in order to bring them into the organisation. We are desperate to get a cross-section of the community involved. We've been doing an awful lot to bring in females into the industry. So we've been working with a number of different organisations to try and help make cybersecurity an attractive proposition to people across the board. The industry is so short of people that actually anything that you can do to the Cyber First initiative and our involvement there with the GCHQ and the National Cybersecurity Centre is to get people, and if we focus on people rather than any particular one subsection, get people into the industry, get them aware of the availability of really good, interesting jobs within the industry. And then once you've got them in, nurture them, train them, give them a good working environment, encourage them, allow them to develop their careers in different ways because nobody wants to follow exactly the same path as somebody else. And we give that partly because we've got the scale that we can do it, where we can let you select the path that's of most interest and most challenge to you.
How do you go about doing that selection? Because, of course, cybersecurity is all about intelligence gathering. And when we put cyber in front, everybody assumes it's sitting in front of a computer tapping a keyboard. But if we look at the bad guys, it's as much about social media. It's about sitting in a pub, having a conversation and extracting enough personal information to attack somebody's online presence.
Absolutely. We see the broad spectrum of social engineering as one of those aspects. So the technical security teams that we have cover a range of skill sets. We have people who specialize in what we would call physical penetration testing, sometimes called black teaming, of getting into a building, getting into a location, which then facilitates a cyber attack. We also have people who specialize in OSINT, as it's called, the open source intelligence gathering. And I can tell you that the number of times where we have been able to gather enough information to craft an email that we can almost guarantee that you will open because we have acquired sufficient information about that individual. I can give you the example. We did a demonstration to the board of a large company. We did some open source intelligence gathering on the managing director. We were able to establish by looking at a combination of their media footprint or their what's sometimes called their digital tattoo. It's more than a footprint because it's permanent. We were able to identify that they were very keen on gin, and we were able to identify not only that they were keen on gin, but the gin shop from which they bought their gin on a regular basis. On the basis of that, we could have crafted an email that said, there's a special offer on from this particular company with a brand new gin that we believe is really ideal for you. They would have clicked on that email and the attachment with it, and that would have compromised their network.
And that's interesting because when we think about spam emails at the moment and then develop into phishing attacks, it tends to start off with a tax refund, which starts off with, here's an invoice that you need to pay. There's a whole range of fairly common subjects. That personalization to that degree is something we don't hear a lot about. How many of the attacks you see out there are beginning to get that degree of sophistication?
We think there's an increasing number. We know that the criminals are getting good at big data manipulation, collecting data from a range of leaks, collecting data from a range of public sources or open sources, and combining that information to produce a really finely crafted spear phishing attack. If they want to go after the CEO or the FD of a company, how much better is it to have done their research on that individual and craft an email that they will open than the spam? Spam is always going to have that sort of mass market email attack is always going to have its role. We've got an online phishing platform that you can hire or you can have it as a consultant-led phishing attack. We generate those phishing attacks for organizations all the time. We can guarantee somebody will open that generic attack. But if you're after a particular individual, better to have done your research on them and know that they'll open it because you focused it and targeted it to them.
So how do you then build your own workforce to be able to do this? Because again, we talk about cybersecurity, we tend to think about people looking for attacks, we tend to talk about people looking for patterns in data traffic. Really, what we're talking about here is big data and analytics being allied to an attack. What does that mean in terms of recruitment?
Our point is we need a range of skill sets. We need people who have the technical skills, and if they haven't got them to a very high level, we bring them in and we train them ourselves. We run we call it the graduate program. They're not all graduates by any means, but it's a 6-month program where we take somebody who has demonstrated that they have the aptitude and basic skills, and over that 6 months, we present them with a range of training opportunities, and that can be a one-on-one session with a specialist in a particular field. It's classroom training, it's project work, and it's actually individual research. One of the things that sets us, I think, as an organization, apart from many others, is we allow our security consultants to spend time on personal research. That's either something that they've chosen as a topic, or it's something where we've been asked. We run a CISO forum, so we run a dinner with 30 CISOs sitting around, and we ask them, what challenges are you looking at? What would you be interested in seeing a reply to or a response to? And then we bring that inside. We have a head of research, we have a chief scientist, they get together and produce research topics for the teams. And then people bid to be part of that to advance their own knowledge and understanding, but also contribute to wider business.
How do you then retain them? Because if you're going to put that amount of investment in to train them up, you're giving them a lot of latitude to go and look at things that are really important to them that may not necessarily be initially monetizable by the business. What are the keys to retaining that staff? Because there's a lot of people out there who would happily take them off your hands.
We are known across the industry as a good employer. We have an attractive work environment where we cater for the fact that in your downtime, that lunchtime break, you will find 6 of our people sitting playing Mario Kart because that's what they want to do in their break time. Fine. We can cope with that. We can cater for that. But we offer them that range of activity, that range of research on the one hand, good, interesting clients on the other hand. And if they do come up with a particular idea, we've actually got a program whereby if you can convince our research board that something is worth developing, we will actually back that. We will draw up a contract with the individual. We put time, effort, money, resources into developing it as an idea. And then for as long as that individual remains with the company, if that is a monetized product, they continue to reap the benefits from it. So they actually get a proportion of the profits. So there's no need for them to go off and set up their own separate business because they can stay within us with the support, the guidance, the financial backing, everything that we can give them, and they make that extra bit of money from it.
And that's quite clever because if we look around a lot of companies, they're in the process of trying to buy security startups all over the place. Part of the challenge of that is that the culture of those people in that startup may be completely opposite to the culture of your organization. So what do you end up with? Do you end up with those people or a bit of technology or a bit of both? You never quite get what made them that startup that you paid all that money for. Do you have any figures on how much you've invested in staff and how effective that's been for you so far?
I don't have the details. I can certainly let you have it, but we have a number of people who are still in the business and are making good money from the product that they dreamt up, that they championed. They did some work in their own time. They came to us and said, look, we think this is a product. We looked at it with them and they've made money from it. It certainly is happening across the business. It's a good model as far as we're concerned. That's not to say we're not acquisitive. We're based in Manchester, but we're a global company and we are expanding both organically by bringing more people into the industry. But we also go out and we cherry pick people and organizations who can give us a really valuable skill set in a particular area. So, for example, one of our last acquisitions was Fox IT. So Fox IT in the Netherlands are world leaders in threat intelligence, have some really dedicated people who have a great deal of experience. They have some fantastic products that currently support organizations like the FSISAC. I think 250 of the world's largest banks take threat intelligence from Fox IT. They see the value in it. We saw the value in the company. We saw we could bring their skill sets in, merge them with those that we've already got inside, and continue to deliver a better resource to our clients. We're out there looking. We bring these companies in. We incorporate them into the organization, provide them with the additional backing of a larger organization with a global footprint. By that, we deliver a better service.
Threat intelligence is quite a challenging issue and actually comes back to the whole big data thing we were talking about earlier. We hear a lot about it. We see a lot of press releases about it. But a lot of it is being kept very private by organisations. There's still not a lot of data sharing going on around threat intelligence. Do we need to do a better job of data sharing, or is it sufficient that we've got enough horsepower from a number of companies being invested into building their own view on what's going on, and that's enough for them to be able to identify attacks?
There is some sharing. So, for example, the FSISAC financial organisations of particular elements of the threat intelligence, but we actually run a platform with our threat intel that enables people who have bought the product to then additionally share in a safe environment particular indicators of compromise that they are seeing, particular issues that they're experiencing. And they can share that either as anonymized or with their own flag attached to it to show that it is from them. That is enabling companies with a similar interest to start sharing data at a really technical level, but also at a higher level. So we bring people together ourselves in things like our CISO Council to get them to share, exchange stories, to share ideas. So yes, I'm a huge believer in shared intelligence, but it has to be done in a good, safe environment where people are willing to talk and share that information. So we offer them that platform as part of our threat intel package.
One of the challenges of information sharing is always going to be privacy. We know GDPR is coming along, and one of the things that I think shocked everybody last year was when the European Court of Justice ruled that dynamic IP addresses actually counted as personal information. It's created quite a stir amongst organisations because that was seen as being something that wasn't easy to tie back, but if you're running the website, actually there's session ID and other data that does allow you to make that linkage. When you talk to customers about sharing data back to you, and when you're gathering data to share out, how much is there becoming a risk that privacy law will impact on the ability to effectively share some of the threat data, particularly when we talk about targeted spear phishing attacks, where the whole key of that is it's an individual or a small group of individuals who are the targets?
You can share data. There is, written into all of the regulations, is the criminal aspect, where if it is to prevent crime, you are allowed to share data. That aspect, I think, doesn't stop us from sharing good, well-qualified threat intelligence because it is there to reduce the threat of crime. So we work, as you can imagine, closely with the National Cybersecurity Centre. We're a big supporter of them. We're very keen to ensure that the work that they do is understood and is made more widely available. The sharing of intelligence is just one element of that. GDPR, General Data Protection Regulations that are coming in, will impose requirements on the clients that we're working with. We are giving a lot of advice and guidance on how you can design privacy into your process, because it has to have privacy by design. It's got to start the process all the way through. There are a lot of requirements on the right to be forgotten, the right to transfer your data, all of these issues. We've got a privacy practice who are out giving that advice and guidance right now. And we would say that if you're not already doing it, talk to us or talk to somebody, but do it now, because the date is getting closer and closer. You just know that the Information Commissioner, who has also been giving some fabulous advice, if you look on their website, there's some really good, very simple, clear and easy to understand advice. They will be looking for an organisation to go, you've made a mess, you've done nothing to get your house in order, and we'll go for a big prosecution and a big fine. Because that will really shock everybody and that will drag everybody out of their complacency. And when you're talking about 4% of your global turnover, you know, a billion here, a billion there, it starts to add up, and they're going to want to do something about it.
We ended up talking about threat intelligence when we were talking about big data and people creating spear phishing attacks. What we're seeing at the moment, if we look on the darknet, is a growth in as-a-service platforms where the tools and the data are being made available to anybody who wants to get in there. They don't have to have a lot of skills. A lot of the tooling is there. When I look on the good guy side, a lot of the tooling isn't there. A lot of the sharing, the collaboration isn't there. What do we need to do, both in terms of being able to widen the people we can pull into this industry, but also in terms of improving our tooling to compete effectively? It'll never be a level playing field, but at least get into the game.
I don't think it will be a level playing field. They will always have the sort of the attack advantage. They choose when, where and how to attack. We, through the threat intelligence, at least can ensure that you've got the best picture available. You need to combine that threat intelligence, the purely technical things, with a wider understanding of your attack surface. And I think if we can work with organisations, we can help clarify that attack surface, make it clear how, who, why, where, what and when the attacks are likely to come in. There are some really simple mitigations that you can put in place to do that. So I think if we can get the basics right, you will have wiped out a lot of the script crypt kiddies or those that have bought this as a service, they won't get the financial advantage if you have done the right things to protect your company.
We started the whole conversation off talking about neurodiversity and bringing people in. And this again comes back into this same challenge. There's a lot of people who have fallen out of school because the schools can't deal with them. They don't have the manpower to be able to tailor a program to them. As a result, they are often very inquisitive people. The internet is there. It's very easy for them to be pulled into cybercrime. How do you begin to reach out and identify those individuals, pull them in, and get them in at a much earlier stage? It goes back partly, I suspect, to what you were saying earlier about they don't need to have a degree, we're looking for some skills.
There are various industry initiatives to try and let people know that the right path, the righteous path, the good guys are out there and need them to come and join them. The Cyber First, as an initiative, is a really good one. There are capture the flag type challenges out there which are really good. The Cyber First, as an initiative, is out there. It's a really good, clear pathway to get people involved in the industry. We, for example, also offer student bursaries. So we're part of that cybersecurity bursary scheme where we offer up to £4,000 to somebody to continue their academic career, to come out with a good degree, and then ideally come back and work for us, because that's part of the commitment from the individual. We're working with universities to send staff to take part in courses. So we send our staff out so that we engage with people early on in their academic careers. And we are doing more and more now earlier in their academic career. We're looking to go out to schools. So we've got people from the teams who will go out and engage with schools, who will go out and talk to people when they're starting to think about careers. Because unless we capture them early and we put them on the path of righteousness, as we've talked about, we're going to lose them. And the more we can do to drag them down the right route, to indicate what is right and what is wrong, there is an ethical issue that we need to make clear. We have, in the discussion here today, when we've been talking about autistic people, some of them have found at an early stage they don't understand that something they're doing is against the law. If we and partners across the industry can get in early, make it clear that there is an awful lot that you can learn without going to a university, as was discussed. There's all sorts of capture the flag and training initiatives that are there. There are YouTube videos that will show you what and how to do it, but we want them to be doing it in a safe environment, working with us rather than becoming somebody that we work against.
How do you reach those who've been abandoned by the school system? And that's perhaps a bit harsh on the school system, but it does have finite resources and there's only so much you can cope with. Some of those may be on the autistic spectrum. Some of them may just have fallen out because they just can't cope with the environment, or because their behaviour, whilst not autistic, is something the school has no ability to handle. They're very easy targets. They're outside of where you're reaching out to at the moment. Where do we start to build programmes? Talk to local education authorities and say, OK, who's excluded? Why are they excluded? How can we provide something to engage them? Because that might be all it needs, is something that is slightly different. It gets their attention. And from that, you can then feed those additional pieces of education in and bring somebody back into the workfold.
I think this is something where we will need government support. I think you'll need central government support to be able to devote sufficient resources to identify those people and to make the right pathways available to them. I don't think any individual company is going to be able to do it. I think there are organisations, there are groups that will be in a position to help, but I still think it needs that steer from central government to ensure that those sorts of people, people who have been excluded, maybe people who are going to the job centres at a young age, maybe what we need to do there is to help them go through the appropriate tests that might indicate that there is a career in cyber for them, something that they may not have considered. Now, again, today, talking with colleagues at the conference here, there are people who are looking to develop a very quick and easy test that will help identify that aptitude with people. And maybe if we can get that test, once it's finalised and comes out, we can get that easily available to people. And maybe you do. You say, OK, somebody's come into a job centre. Well, sit down and do this test. See what the result is. And it might just give you that indication of to a career prospect that you just hadn't considered in the past.
You've had the experience of working with people with neurodiversity. You've built all these cyber programs. You're reaching out to schools. There are a lot of commercial companies out there who haven't started, often because they don't know where to start. Could you just give some pointers to those companies as what they could do, what they should expect, but also why it's cost effective to do this?
Who's the National Autistic Society, who are here today, are a very easy first step. Look at their website, join up, get their newsletter. They are very keen at helping businesses make the necessary adaptations that you might want to put in place around the wording of your advert to make it more friendly to autistic people. It may just be that you need to adjust your recruitment process, whereas you might initially want to do a telephone sift. Some autistic people don't react well to a telephone interview, but are much better in person. There are little adaptations, little adjustments that you can make to ensure that you're not unnecessarily ruling somebody out of a recruitment process who really, really should be in that process because of the benefits that they can bring to the business. Yes, it may require a little bit of adjustment. Once you've made that adjustment, it's then adjusted for all time. It's not something you have to repeat on a regular basis. Just make sure that your advert, the wording of your advert, is friendly. There's been a wonderful anecdote given today where somebody said to an autistic person, I need this done, it's got to be done absolutely 100%, it's got to be detailed and accurate and correct and right, and I need it by Friday. Well, there's an instant challenge. You can either have one or the other. Clarify which one you want. Don't expect them to be able to necessarily, and it's not for all of them, but some of them will find that a particular challenge. You either want it 100%, in which case I will do that and deliver it to you, or you want it by Friday. But you can't have both. Just think about the wording, the language that you're using, the way the things are presented, and it's an adjustment that you would make for somebody where English wasn't their first language. It may be you would have to adjust it for somebody who was visually impaired or somebody who was hearing impaired. All of these different adjustments are very, very small, but can deliver a population, deliver a community to your business who you might have either ignored in the past or not been seen as friendly. They're there. There are people with fabulous skills. We've just got to get them into the industry.
Tim, thank you for your time today.
And you, Ian. Thank you.